You are listening to Bible Direction for Life, the sermon podcast of Westside Baptist Church in Bremerton, Washington. We pray that the preaching and teaching you hear on this podcast connects the truth of the Bible to your life, that you would learn more about the triune God who made you and what he made you for. This Sunday, I filled in for Pastor Peter and preached from 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 17 through 19. So before we get to our exact text, which is actually verses 17 through 19, I want to read a phrase that one of the verses from earlier on in the chapter, verse number 8. And having food and raiment, let us be therewith content. So if you have food and you have clothes, all is good. Be content. Now that's a very low standard for what we have in order to be content, right? I mean, just food, just clothing. And notice he doesn't say that, you know, having nothing, be content. He says, you need food to live. You need clothing. So if you don't have food, don't be content with starvation. Go find some food. If you don't have clothing, don't be content with nakedness. Go get some clothes for the sake of yourself and society. And then he says, but if you've got that, then be content. Be at peace. What more could you demand? Now, it's a low standard of living for what it takes for us to be content, but that is an enormously high bar for our hearts. It's hard for us to even imagine what it would be like to be in a scenario where all we have is food and clothing, but that's it. I mean, it'd be like you leave from here today, you get in your car, you're going home, you turn the corner into your neighborhood, and there are emergency vehicles everywhere. And then as you turn the corner and you get to your house, you notice that it is your house they are surrounding. And what used to be your house is nothing more than a smoldering pile of rubble. All of your stuff is gone. Your second vehicle gone. Your camper trailer gone. Everything gone. And so then you go to a friend's house. You know, someone invites you over, of course, and wants to help take care of you. And you go out to your car to get something you left, and you realize it's been stolen out of their driveway. And so then you go to call the rental agency and rent a car. And you find out there's been identity fraud and your credit card has been canceled. And then you go to your bank account and find out that the same person who stole your identity also drained your bank accounts, and that there's no quick way to solve this. And so your whatever money you're going to get back is all frozen up. You've got nothing. And then on top of that, your land deed is gone. And I don't know, the example keeps going on to crazy, ridiculous lengths because it would be a ridiculous scenario, but imagine having nothing but the clothes you're wearing and the food that your friend has in their pantry that they're going to share with you, and that's all you've got. Would you be content? I don't think many of us would just really cavalierly say, oh yeah, of course. I mean, it's just stuff. I'm fine. I'd be good. I'd be at peace. I don't think any of us would be that brazen, but I think we would all aspire to be like our heroes, right? Like people in the Bible like Job, who was able to lose everything he had and still not curse God. We would aspire to be like the early church fathers who were martyrs for their faith, who lost everything because of following Jesus, and yet they still remained faithful to God and were content with the situation that they had. We'd aspire to be like that, like Paul, for instance. We aspire to be that kind of person, so we hope that maybe by reading all these stories, by being in church, that, and then by the work of the Spirit in our lives in that moment, that there would be an ability for us to be content, even having lost everything. We all hope that. But the truth is that is a ridiculous example, because none of us are even close to losing all of that. And even to imagine the possibility of losing all of that is to go to ridiculous lengths. We all have way more than just food and just clothing. We are all very rich. But in spite of the fact that our material condition right now is so much higher than where Paul says it needs to be in order for you to be content, we all know what it's like to be discontent even in this situation, don't we? Right? Like, we all have food. We all have breakfast. But you know how frustrating it is and how maddening it can be to go to the pantry and there's not the type of cereal that you wanted, right? Or you pour the cereal and you go to the refrigerator and there's no milk. The frustrations, the problems, the sacrifices you have to make, right? The struggles that we have that just even missing one meal can make us angry and mad and change our whole temperament of our person. And it's not even like we're going without much at all. We have good clothing. This morning you went to a closet and you probably chose between multiple sets of clothes. I'm guessing, maybe. And we all know what it's like to look at our 72 different outfits that we've got in the closet and be frustrated and discontent with the fact that, well, these are so old, or these fashions are out of style, or, you know, I've just wore the same thing forever. And it's usually the one or two outfits that you always wear, and then everything else just stays hanging on the closet. Like, we know what it's like to have so much, and yet to be so discontent in our hearts in spite of having so much available to us. Now, this discontent, though, is not... this discontent is dangerous, very dangerous. This discontent is not just a cobweb in the corner of the house, right? That's a little bit tacky, and if someone notices, you don't like the fact that someone called you out on it. But overall, it's not really much of a problem. This discontent is a crack in the foundation. It's rot in the timber. It's a real problem to your soul. Because as you are discontent, the temptation is then to chase wealth, to chase things, the material possessions, and use God as a means of chasing it. That's the temptation that endangers your soul. And the scriptures are full of warnings against this. Proverbs 15:27 says, "He that is greedy for gain troubleth his own soul." His own house, sorry. Jesus, remember the story of the rich man who comes to Jesus? And he says, "What, Master, what do I need to do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus says, "Well, you got to keep the commandments." "You keep the commandments?" "Yeah, I keep the commandments." "Okay, so one more thing you need to do. Go sell everything that you have and give it to the poor. And then come back and we'll talk about following me." And the man walks away. He doesn't follow Jesus. And why? Because he had a bunch of stuff and he didn't want to get rid of it. And Jesus says to his disciples, "Do you know how hard it is for a rich man to get into heaven? You want to know how hard that is? It's like this. You've got a needle and you've got a camel. Fit that camel through the eye of that needle." The disciples say, "Well, Lord, who in the world can be saved then?" And Jesus says, "Well, with man, this is impossible. Absolutely impossible. But with God, all things are possible." Paul, even in this chapter, just after the verse I read earlier, in verse number 8, he says, "But they that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare." Now, when he says "they that will be rich," what he's saying is those who, not just those who become rich, but those who will to be rich, whose desire and drive and goal is that they would be rich, that they would have things and have wealth and possessions and comfort, right? That those who will be rich fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and hurtful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is the root of all evil, which, while some have coveted after, they have erred from the faith, piercing themselves through with many sorrows. So, I mean, these are very, very intense warnings about our handling of our wealth, that it's so easy for wealth to become a god. Jesus even says that you cannot serve God and money. The two things are competing gods in some ways in our hearts. And they can, and you cannot serve money and God at the same time. One of them is going to win out. And that's the problem, is that people start pursuing wealth as a means to gain. And these false teachers here that Timothy is dealing with are people who have begun to equate gain with godliness, is how Paul describes it. That they see gain as the same thing as godliness. Basically, we've entered into this contract with God. So we've made this agreement that I'm going to offer these sacrifices. This is the same way that the pagans would do it. I'm going to offer these sacrifices and keep these rituals and obey these laws. And if I keep my part of the bargain, then God keeps his and he repays with material blessings, whether that's the crops do well, or I have many children and they're all healthy and they grow to adulthood, or whether that looks like my family has a position and status in the city. Right, like whatever it is that we're going to the gods for, we go, we keep our part of the bargain, and the God keeps theirs. That's the way that these false teachers are beginning to view reality as a result of these their approach to riches warping their mind. And so the problem is that if one begins to pursue wealth, if one wills to be rich, and that begins to be the thing that drives them, then they will at some point run into a time where it's either it's not godliness is gain, it's godliness or gain. And they have to make the decision whether or not they're going to continue to pursue God or whether they're going to pursue their wealth. Because pursuing, following Jesus inevitably means sacrifice. Because we follow Jesus, and who is he? He's the one who died in our place. The Father who gave his Son, who sacrificed his Son for us. And so if we're going to follow him, we are going to follow in the steps of sacrifice, which means that godliness is going, it's unavoidable that on the path to following Jesus, we are going to have to sacrifice something. And the person who sees gain as godliness is going to be faced with a temptation to either, on the one hand, abandon godliness altogether and say, you know what, I want the life of riches and wealth, and following God doesn't seem to be the way to get there, so I'm going to totally abandon faith and go after wealth. Or they're going to be tempted to redefine the faith to actually serve their purposes. And the redefined faith is no faith at all. It begins to be the faith of the pagans. Right? So this is the dangerous scenario that our hearts face. We are people who have a lot of stuff, and the temptation is that we are going to become discontent with the things that we have, and that discontent is going to lead to pursuing wealth, and pursuing wealth is going to become the idol, and then eventually Jesus is left behind in the dust. And that's why our discontent, the small tones of discontent in our heart are so dangerous to us, because in the end, they can lead us away from following Jesus. So then, since we are rich, how do we be rich and not lose our soul? How do we be rich people like we are and yet not abandon the faith to pursue riches? And that's what Paul gets to in our text. So read along with me, follow along with me in verse number 17. Charge them that are rich in this world that they be not high-minded, nor trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God, who giveth us richly all things to enjoy, that they do good, and that they be rich in good works, ready to distribute, willing to communicate, laying up in store for themselves a good foundation against the time to come, that they may lay hold on eternal life. So I've got two condensed, what he said here, down into two kind of main ideas that we're going to deal with. So how to be rich without losing your soul. Number one, we trust the giver and enjoy his gifts. And number two, we do good and be generous with the wealth. So let's start with the first one. Charge them that are rich in the world that they be not high-minded. So he starts by giving a warning against pride. This is the exact sin, the temptation, the struggle that the false teachers have. If we look at the beginning of chapter 6, verse number 3, if any man teach otherwise and consent not to the wholesome words, even to the words of our Lord Jesus Christ, and to the doctrine which is according to godliness, he is proud, knowing nothing. That it is this haughtiness and this pride in the heart of the false teachers that leads them to assuming that gain is godliness and pursuing gain instead of God. And so the first warning to the people who are rich is that they would be not high-minded and not trust in their riches. Now, what does it look like to be high-minded when facing God with our riches? Well, if they're coming into this situation as opposed to trusting the living God. So look first at the contrast. That he says, don't trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God, who giveth us richly all things to enjoy. The arrogance that these false teachers have when they come to God demanding these things of God is in their contractual way that, okay, God, we're going to do our part. We're going to live like you have told us to live, and we expect that godliness is going to equal gain. That attitude, if I were to make a contract with you, right? Let's say I have some land and you want to farm. So you've got the equipment and the seed, stuff to farm. I have the land, and I make this contract with you that, hey, I'll let you use my land and farm on it, but you're going to give me 20% of the proceeds. Then there are some assumptions in this contract that we make with one another. One of the assumptions is that I actually own the land and I'm not trying to rent out someone else's land. Another assumption is that you are going to do all of the work on the field. I'm not going to do any of it. And that's all going to be you. You're going to provide the seed. You're going to provide the equipment. You're going to provide the labor. All of that is going to be on you. You're going to get that harvest off to the co-op or wherever it's going. You're going to sell it, and then I'm going to get those 20% of that proceeds. I'm assuming a lot on your end of what you're going to do of what you're going to do with it. When the relationship with God then is treated like a contract, it's as though the assumptions that are being made is that I have something to bargain with, right? Like that, okay, there are these assumptions that we make. I have life, and I can act, and I have intelligence, and I am going to do these things, and then God is going to return to me whatever I think I'm going to get from God. The problem is that God is the one who giveth us all things. So another word for the assumptions that we make there are the givens, right? These things that are just given, that you are alive, that you have breath. Well, who gave the givens? Well, it's God. And so you don't have anything to bargain with in this contract when you come to God looking for something from him. You've got none, you have no leverage on your side because all that you have comes from him. And so to go to God and to act like you have something to bargain with, to act like you have something to say, God, here, I've done this, you keep your end of the bargain, is to be so proud as to not realize that everything that you have, the life that you have, the strength that you have, the health that you have, the resources you have at your disposal, the friends and the opportunities that you have, all of that has been given to you by God. And so you really come into this whole bargain with nothing. And God's like, well, sure, that's great, but what are you going to use? Well, I'm going to use, you know, the breath and strength that I have. Well, who gave you that breath and who gave you that strength? Well, God did. So it would be incredibly arrogant to go into the pursuit of wealth thinking that God owes you something because God has actually given you everything that is. And therefore, the person who is on the opposite side, humble and willing to admit that they have nothing, are in a position then to receive these things as gifts from God. Because all of it is grace. All of it is God's gift. And that we trust not in the uncertain riches. Because if we trust in the riches themselves, riches are uncertain. God is not. Riches are temporary and transient, but the giver of those gifts will always be there, and he's always got more to give. So it'd be much better to go back to the nursery rhyme, don't kill the goose that gives the golden egg, right? Like, don't pursue the golden eggs, pursue the goose. Go for God, not for what you can get out of God. So first, trust the giver, not the gifts. And then secondly, he says that he gives us richly all things to enjoy. That the gifts of God, these things that he's given to us, have been given to us for our enjoyment. And so we should enjoy them. Now that might seem a little counterintuitive, because it would seem if we don't want to see the wealth that we have turn into an idol, that one of the things we'd want to stay away from is enjoying it too much or enjoying the thing at all. In fact, it'd seem better to maintain some kind of distance from the thing, because then that would actually keep it from becoming an idol in our hearts. But this is kind of like, imagine if on Christmas you gave your kid a box of Legos and said, here's your Lego set, son. Oh, great, Dad, that's wonderful. And then he walks away and he puts it in the closet. Like, wait, what are you putting in the closet? Well, I'm just putting it in there. And then your son walks away and he doesn't look at the Legos. He doesn't make the Legos. He doesn't build with them and play with them. And you're beginning to wonder, wait a second, I gave him this. You know why I gave him these Legos? So that he would enjoy these Legos. And either he thinks that either there's something wrong between me and him, or maybe he thinks there's something wrong with the gift and he doesn't like the gift. But why would he not play with and enjoy the Legos that I gave him? It's the same thing with God. If God gave us these things to enjoy, then our denial of enjoying them is either to say that the gift itself is bad, that these things that God has given are bad, or that the God who gave them is bad, and that there's something that we don't want to be in his debt or something along those lines. I think that the reasons that we don't enjoy those gifts is because, well, one of them could be just that we don't want to destroy them, right? We're trying to hang on to them too tightly. It's like I have a pet peeve about people who leave the protective wrap on any kind of appliances or electronics or something like that, and they just leave it on there for, you know, years, and it's all peeling and looks disgusting, and they're trying to protect the thing that they bought by leaving the protective wrapper on, you know? It's like, we don't want to take it off and really use the thing, because if we used it, if we enjoyed it, it might actually get destroyed. And that's an attitude of trying to hang on to things that are uncertain in a way that makes them eternal. Another reason we might have a difficulty enjoying the gifts of God is because it's no gift at all. It's something that you stole, something that you achieved by your own swindling or your own manipulation of a system, and it's not really a gift from God, it's something that you've taken or stolen. That, of course, should be repented of. Restitution should be made, things should be returned and put back to normal before you can enjoy the gifts of God. But then I think there's other ways that we don't enjoy the gifts of God. One of them is just that sense of shame that I don't deserve this thing. Whether it's a nice home or a good car or some clothes or some kind of entertainment, that I don't deserve this. I mean, this isn't something that God should be giving me or that I deserve to have this nice of a situation. And the truth is that's exactly right. You don't deserve it. But humility accepts the things that we have as gifts from God and enjoys them, accepting that this is His love. This is an expression of His kindness to us. Another way that maybe another reason we don't enjoy the gifts of God is just because we think that if we enjoy the gifts of God, or the gifts that God has given us, that will inevitably pull us away from God Himself. It's as if that our attention and our love for things are this zero-sum pie. And then if I really enjoy hiking and going outdoors, if I really enjoy movies, if I really enjoy whatever your thing is, whatever the thing is that you enjoy that God has given you to do, if I really enjoy putting that car together or whatever it is, that somehow now that's less enjoyment that I'm enjoying God or less time I'm giving to the things of God. And it's just, it actually is a way that our enjoyment of the things here on earth expands our ability to enjoy or to understand the enjoyment of other things. The best way to illustrate this for me is with my grandmother. My grandmother used to always say that she couldn't wait for heaven because in heaven she was going to ride horses on a beach with Jesus. And that was her thing. That's what she was going to be doing when she got to heaven. She was going to go get, she had, I don't remember what exact kind of horse, but she had a very specific vision of what this was going to look, what heaven was going to look like. And it was her riding horses on a beach with Jesus. And I always thought, man, that is so, we don't know what heaven's going to be like, Grandma. This isn't the kind of thing that, I felt almost sacrilegious to think that way, to think that concretely about heaven. And felt that for a long time. But then eventually, thanks to a book I read and some talks with friends, I came to see it a little bit differently. That my grandmother, if you told her, asked her, what do you want to do more than anything else in the world? Like, what would be the thing that would really pique her enjoyment in this world? It would be probably riding horses on the East Coast beach with her family at sunrise. With the people she loved, that is probably peak enjoyment in her life, if that ever happened. That would be top of it all. And that then became the metaphor that she began to understand heaven as being like. Heaven is like that thing that you enjoy so much. And when we learn to enjoy the things that God has given to us as gifts, not as things that we have taken, not as things we're striving to, but just receive them and enjoy them as the good gifts of God, it actually is a way of enjoying God Himself. It's a way of expanding our ability to enjoy God and to say, you know what? I love Jesus even more than I love riding horses. I love Jesus even more than I love going on hikes in the mountains. I love Jesus even more than these things. And the more that our ability and passion can grow for other things, Jesus is always going to be better than whatever it is that you love. And so your passion can always grow and expand to that. And so putting the guardrails on our enjoyment, allowing us to trust in the giver and to enjoy the gifts He's given, we have to be grateful to Him. We have to realize that He is the one that's given these things and trust in Him, not in the things. And then just enjoy the things as they were meant to be enjoyed, as they were meant to be enjoyed by the giver who gave them to us. So then let's look in verse number 18. That they do good and that they be rich in good works, ready to distribute, willing to communicate. So when he says there, if you're going to be rich in anything, if you're going to pursue riches, pursue being rich in doing good works for one another. Be ready to distribute and willing to communicate. These are just ways to say be generous. Now, saying do good is a very, very broad command. I mean, it's like, you know, when things are kind of going awry with the kids in the back bedrooms. What do parents yell back? Hey, kids, be good. Or when you're getting ready to send your kid off to a friend's house or something like, hey, now remember, be good. And what are we saying when we say be good? Well, we're saying a whole lot. We're saying, you know, don't wipe your boogers on our friends. You know, we're saying don't use a bad tone of voice. We're saying, you know, don't, if you are given a snack, then don't take too much. Don't, you know, be rude in how much you take. Don't take it from other people. We're saying a lot when we say be good. It's the generic category for be the kind of person you're supposed to be. We don't have time when the kids are all, when there's like 72 house violations happening in the back bedroom to say, hey kids, don't talk to your sister that way. And that Lego's not actually yours, that's theirs. And you, we're not going to sort out all the minutia. We just say do good, right? And that do good can include, a, like there are certain boundaries on it, but then inside the fences, there's a lot that they can go do. That could mean you go play with Legos. That could mean you go play a board game or a card game. That could mean you go outside and swing on the swings or run in the woods. That, there's all sorts of things that fall under the category of the do good. That has, it has boundaries, and then it's got a wide open space for them to run in. And that's what it means in the Bible when we talk about good works or doing good. It's this kind of thing. The broad category of what were you made for? What opportunities do you have? What skills has God given you? And in this case, specifically, what are the riches, the wealth that you have? Whether that wealth is in the form of knowledge, whether that wealth is in the form of resources that you've got at your disposal, opportunities, what has God given you? And then go do good with it. Use it for good. So if that means that you can serve the community by being a mechanic, then go be a mechanic. If that means that you can serve the community by doing your job, whatever that job is, just do it. And that's, this is really how we need to start thinking about vocation in general, is that it's not about getting a paycheck. If we only go to work just to get a paycheck, if we only perform our duties just to get money, then how is that not being the person who just wills to be rich in that environment, in that scenario? What we need to do is let God transform our hearts towards our work. And that doesn't mean that you have to go find a new line of work tomorrow. That just means that God transforms our hearts to our works to see that these things that we are doing, whether wherever they are benefiting our community. When you show up to work and you do a good job, you are benefiting the community. Mom, when you raise a kid, you are benefiting the community. When you interact with your neighbor and have a polite conversation and you work together on some project in your neighborhood, that is building the community. Whatever your skills and opportunities, and this kind of thing is necessarily vague because there are so many options, and this should be the thing that we pursue. I think growing up, I tended to think that the fences were the most important thing about the Christian life, like the boundaries, the boundary lines of where we should not go. Those were the most important things, and that was where the attention was given, because those can be very particular. Don't do this. But then the do good command is like, well, you've got a whole world. I mean, this is God in the garden, right? God says, don't eat of this tree. But you've got an entire garden and an entire world to go out and do stuff in. And I want you to go and take dominion of that world. Go and rule it well. And that's the most wonderful part about these, what God is saying here, or what I find so exciting about this kind of passage, is that he says, take the things that I've given you and just go do good. Whatever that means in your specific life. That can be anything. That's not limited to what's going on in an official church ministry. I mean, even there's a verse in Proverbs, he that withholdeth corn, the people shall curse him. And so you would kind of think that the next thing is, so that person who gives it away, he's going to be blessed. Well, what does it say? Blessing shall be upon the hand of him that selleth it. So do you have a good you can produce? Well, produce it and sell it. That's a blessing to the community. Do you have a service you can provide? Well, do that. And sir, that is a way of serving and blessing the community. Whatever it is that God's given you to do, put your hand to it and work at it and see God bless it. And then be generous. And this is more than just doing good. This is generosity toward those who don't have. And I think the best way to understand it is, if God has given us these gifts to enjoy, whatever those gifts are, a nice house, a wonderful family, good friendships, a love of, you name it, something that you really enjoy, invite other people into the enjoyment of those gifts. So if God is, if you love food and you love cooking, then host a dinner party and have people over and introduce them to flavor combinations that they never would have thought of and that blows their mind. Or maybe, you know, makes them gag. Either one. But introduce them. Broaden their palate. Expose them to more. If you enjoy it, invite other people into your enjoyment of it. If you enjoy hiking, take someone on a hike. If you enjoy working on vehicles, invite someone to come work on your vehicle. I don't expect a ton of take-ups on that all the time. But if you, whatever it is that God has given you that's a source of joy for you, and that you have the opportunity to participate in, invite other people into that. Be generous with people who don't have. If you have food and you know people who don't have a lot of food, share some food with them. If you have money and you know people who don't have a lot of money who are struggling to get by, share that with them. If you have extra and you just don't know where to put it, the church has a benevolence fund that's made for exactly those kinds of situations. There are so many ways that we can share our wealth with other people. The temptation is always going to be to think that maybe this is all just stuff. And you know, thinking about the stuff I enjoy, the electronics, the toys, the house, the sports activities, the sports equipment, all the whatever it is that is the stuff that you enjoy and the wealth that you have, it can be easy to just think, oh, this is all just stuff, and it doesn't matter. It's not going to last for eternity, so don't mind with it. But look at 19, verse 19. Laying up in store for themselves a good foundation against the time to come. So you're right, in one sense. Wealth does not translate into heaven. You're not going to show up at heaven's door with truckfuls of all of your wealth and say, hey, I'm here to exchange this for, you know, heaven currency. It's not going to work that way. When you're there, and you're done. Your time for translating the currency is past. But our opportunity to change earthly wealth into eternal wealth is right now. You have that opportunity, and that is what I see happening here at Westside all the time. So much has happened around your wealth that has been a blessing to me. That it's not just been meals, it's been the building of friendships. It's not just a nice house, it's a place where people gather and study the Word of God together and pray and weep and cry and then deal with problems and then laugh and joke and play. Like, that's what the house is. And it's not just a movie, it's a time to hang out with a friend. It's not just a sports activity, it's a time to invite someone to experience something that they never did and form a bond that is going to last for eternity. Yeah, those dirt bikes might not, but that friendship, that relationship will. The things that you have, no, they're not going to last forever, but this, it is kind of around this stuff, is how we build the friendships and the things that do last for eternity. So if you want to make this stuff last for something beyond this world, then use it right now to be a blessing and to do good and to serve other people and to serve the work that God has given you to do. And that is going to be as unique and varied as every one of you who are here. And it takes work. It takes attention and thinking about these things to figure out what has God given me, take an account of what do I have, and then figuring out how to give it away. And not just giving it away, but be generous with it in a way that is going to actually serve the people around you. But that is the work that God has called us to do if we are going to be people who are rich, and we are, and yet people who are not distracted by that wealth where that wealth becomes ultimate. People who can, when the tragedy strikes, not be torn apart, not fall apart, because in the way that we've handled our wealth while we had it, we managed it in such a way that we were always remembering, always worshiping God the whole way through, so that when it's all gone, we still have God. We still have our faith. We still have Jesus. And if we have that, then, as Paul says, godliness with contentment is great gain. Paul is not against serving God for gain. He's against serving God for the wrong gain. And the greatest gain we have by serving God is God himself. That is what we're here for. And only by handling wealth in a way that acknowledges that and allows us to keep worshiping him are we going to be the kind of people who can who can be joyful when we have nothing and joyful when we have everything. So let's pray this morning. Father, I thank you so much for your word, and I pray now that you would work on hearts and show us how we can do good. Lord, expand our imaginations that we would be able to see ways that we can bless others, ways that we can more properly enjoy the gifts you've given us ourselves, and Lord, that we just any way that we can invite other people into our enjoyment of the good gifts that you've given. I pray that you would build our church up around the riches and the wealth that we have. We ask all this in the name of Jesus.
Thank you for listening to this message. If you would like to learn more about the Westside Baptist Church, please visit our website, www.BibleDirectionForLife.com. Subscribe to the podcast if you would like to hear new sermons and lessons each week. And remember that a sermon podcast is no substitute for opening up a Bible and reading for yourself.